unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام إن الحسد ليأكل الإيمان كما تأكل النار الحطب.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam stated, "Jealousy consumes faith like fire consumes dry wood."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Dear friends, in the beautiful conversations of Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, I ran across a very interesting dialogue, a very interesting discussion that Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam has with one of his companions. It's interesting, but when talking about the disobedience of Allah and the love of Allah and the relationship between the two, Imam al-Baqir talks to his companion and says, "He who disobeys Allah does not recognize him." Again, "He who disobeys Allah does not recognize Allah." Now here, dear friends, it's interesting, but we can just talk about this tradition in itself, right? So for example, if you disobey Allah, that means that you have taken Allah to be something of less concern, something that is not of great concern to you or to I, right? If we really recognize the might and the power and the awe and the grandeur and the majesty and the beauty and the greatness of Allah, it would be very, very difficult to disobey Him. And of course, if one was to perhaps reach the knowledge and the wisdom and the ma'rifah, the recognition, the awareness of Allah at the level of prophets or at the levels of imams or at the levels of these great scholars like Imam Khomeini or Imam Khamenei, we will find that because of these people's great and amazing recognition of Allah, the disobedience on their behalf is minimized. And in the case of prophets and imams, to the extent where they do not disobey Allah. So, dear friends, if we are disobeying Allah, then it means we do not recognize Allah. And if we do not recognize Allah, then how can we love God? How can we love Allah if we do not know Him? So, if we do not recognize Allah, we won't love Him. And if we don't recognize Him and we don't love Him, then of course disobeying Allah will be something easy for us to do. Now, before we end, keep in mind that there is a big difference in disobeying Allah and not caring, and on the other hand, disobeying Allah, but being very regretful and trying our best to not continue to disobey Allah. The one who disobeys Allah and doesn't care about them disobeying Allah, surely is in a very bad position. But the one who perhaps mistakenly, out of weakness, out of weakness, disobeys Allah, but is regretful, yes, they are relatively in a better place. So, dear friends, recognize Allah so that you love Allah, and in return, you don't disobey Allah. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Baqir, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
One very simple advice from the Imam that he gave to Umar ibn Abdul Aziz. Umar ibn Abdul Aziz is the only Umayyad Khalifa who is considered to be the most just. Sayyid Razi, you know, the compiler of Nahj al-Balagha, was a man of letters, expert in Arabic literature. And that was the focus when he compiled the sayings of Ali. And he was a very accomplished poet in his own right. He has two lines of poetry. And since he's a Sayyid, he's from Banu Hashim, he says that if the eyes of a Hashimi would ever shed tears on a Umawi, it will be on Umar ibn Abdul Aziz. Because of his, you know, goodness and kindness towards the Ahlul Bayt. There were certain, you know, meetings between the fifth Imam and Umar ibn Abdul Aziz. In one of the meetings, when the Imam was now leaving the gathering, Umar ibn Abdul Aziz says, "Can you give me an advice before you leave?" And Imam said a very short sentence, which is even for us, especially those who are in the position of power and authority, wherever they are, whether at home, in their office, in a community, or the society, or whatever, where he says, "Usika bi taqwa Allah." Number one, I advise you to have the taqwa of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And then he says, "Wattakhiz al-kabir aban, was-saghir waladan, war-rajul akhan." He says, then look at the person you are dealing with. If he is older than you, consider him like your father. If he is younger than you, consider him to be like your son. If he is same as your age, consider him to be your brother. If you start looking at people from that perspective, then your attitude will change. And that is where we will have peace and harmony. And I think we need here quite a lot. This is not for Umar ibn Abdul Aziz only. This is for each one of us. When we deal with one another, an elderly person is like the father, young ones are like our children, and those who are on the same age are like our brothers.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
biggest tree.
Before I got to know my Lebanon when I returned home as a teenager, I knew the Lebanese poet Gibran Khalil Gibran. Those famous lines from his famous books are often remembered. For instance, out of suffering have emerged the strongest souls. The most massive characters are seared with scars. The explosion that shook our city of Beirut a year ago today was something we have never seen in any Hollywood movie. I don't know of it if it's possible to make such a scene in even an animated movie either. I give only one piece of information to explain the horror of the incident. The quivering of this explosion was a 3.5 on the Richter scale. 218 people were killed in the blast of Beirut, a few of whom were on ground zero at the time of the explosion were never found. More than 7,000 were injured, and more than 300,000 people became instantly homeless. People from around the world expressed their sorrow at the suddenness of the incident, but the first punch was thrown by former U.S. President Donald Trump. In a briefing at the White House shortly after the incident, he claimed that the explosion was a massive bomb attack. This raised a whole lot of questions for everyone as to who might have done it, how, and most importantly, why. On the other hand, the Lebanese government claimed since the beginning of the incident that more than 2,700 tons of ammonium nitrate were stored in the warehouse where the incident took place at the seaport. This made every one of us wonder why this huge amount of ammonium has been stored in a densely populated area since 2014. The fact so far is that the ammonium was recovered from a ship brought in illegally and stored in a warehouse at the seaport since 2014, and a whole lot of officials knew about it, including heads of state, prime ministers, and even, or rather mainly, the commander-in-chief of the Lebanese armed forces. The atrocity encapsulated everything that is rotten about Lebanon's governing system. The rampant corruption, the incompetent inaction, a system held hostage by a foreign power whose potence to be Lebanese defenders shattered this nation many times over. And last but not least, our eternal enemy, Israel, that benefited from every atrocity that have ever fallen upon my people, whether they had a hand in it or not. The lesson of the August 4 atrocity is that accepting that the U.S.-French imposed regime means accepting leaders who think nothing of murdering their own citizens. If we allow Lebanon to continue fragmenting, it opens the door to catastrophes of an infinitely greater magnitude than the port explosion. This disaster must be our wake-up call for inaugurating a new Lebanon. There's no salvation for a system that is rotten to the core pushed by Western colonial powers. Our salvation is through collectively banishing those who colluded in Lebanon's downfall and who remain wedded to a medieval and inherently corrupt sectarian system. About 100 years ago, in 1923, Gibran wrote in The Prophet, "You need to know the secret of death. How can you know the secret if you do not know life?" But today, Gibran's Beirut does not know the secret of death as we struggle to decipher the meaning of our lives on this beautiful yet battered piece of land. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. A year after the explosion that rocked Beirut on August 4th, 2020, killing 218 people, injuring more than 7,000, and devastating much of the city, the Lebanese investigation into the blast has yielded no credible results. Families of the victims, some of whom are calling for an international investigation, are sadly being beaten by riot police a year after the tragedy for simply demanding the truth about what killed their kids, their mothers, their fathers, their loved ones. A year after the explosion, none of the victims' families in Lebanon have been asked to give witness statements, nor have they received any form of official apology or even been contacted by Lebanese authorities. Families of the victims and every Lebanese citizen wants answers to their many questions. They want to know why the ammonium nitrate was in the port, who ordered it, And what's happened to the rest of it since just 750 tons out of the 2,750 stored there reportedly exploded? Just imagine what would have happened to Beirut and its greater surrounding areas had the 2,750 tons exploded. I can't imagine. We want to know if there were other explosives kept in that port and how the fire that triggered the explosion was started and whether it was really just a fire or was it an act of terrorism. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is member of the Lebanese Parliament, Dr. Ibrahim Moussaoui from the Loyalty to the Resistance Bloc Hezbollah. Thank you very much, Dr. Moussaoui, for being with us. A year on after the largest non-nuclear explosion in history, how do you set the scene post-blast, pandemic-ridden, financially beaten Lebanon?
Well, this is, first of all, thank you for having me on the show.
Pleasure.
What we're about actually to talk about now, we're talking about one of the worst catastrophes ever. We're talking here about a disaster that was man-made. It's whether it's negligence, whether it's in purpose, whatever the reason is. All of this time that has passed, we're about like two days from now, and we're going to have the first anniversary for this tragedy that happened in Lebanon. We've been waiting, and we continue to wait for the judiciary to come out and to give the victims some tribute, to give their families some answers for the very important questions about what happened. We're not telling them to tell us about the secret issues, the secret side of the investigation. We know very well, and we believe in the secrecy of the investigation. It should be kept. It should be classified for one reason or another, because we wanted justice. Justice is what we seek. But still, now there are things that can be told to the people, to the public opinion, to all the Lebanese parties, to all the Lebanese factions, to the international community. And if you know, and we know that for a fact, that the Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, has come two times, and he has sought this. He has said that we want the judiciary to come and tell us, the one who is taking the responsibility of the investigation, to come and tell us about the general lines of what happened, general lines of how did this explosion happen. Because you know very well that Hezbollah is being accused by certain parties, and they are investing.
We will talk about that extensively, but Dr. Moussaoui, 218 people died in the Beirut explosion, yet the survivors have been abandoned for slow, torturous deaths, or maybe sickness from hunger, from poverty, from lack of medicine, and from the political turmoil that is possibly yet to come to the country. What has Hezbollah done so far within its jurisdiction as part of the government and as part of the Lebanese parliament as well to ensure justice is to be served at least to the survivors?
Actually, one very important issue, we are not, there is a government and there is a statesmanship. There is a state that should handle the whole matter. You are exactly right. We are part of the government. We are part of the parliament. And we should be responsible one way or another in order to make sure, ensure that justice is going to take its place. To tell you the truth, I am in the Committee of Justice and Administration in the Lebanese parliament. And we have gone through this issue deeply. We have brought opinions, legal opinions from judges, from authorities, some people who have authority over such issues, and they themselves said when we got this appeal from the judiciary that they want the parliamentarians or some MPs who were ministers at the time to come and appear before the court, we have tried as much as we can in order to take a legal decision. No legal conclusion has come to us that the parliament has any evidence or has any premises where they can build upon to present those to the judiciary. That's why the Lebanese parliament has taken the initiative to direct accusations, and in order to later on present a committee that is going to be composed of eight judges from the Lebanese judiciary, 7 MPs from the Lebanese parliament, and they are going to go into deep investigation for those who are accused of negligence or of whatever.
Why did it take so much time? It's been a year.
Yeah, it's been a year because, to tell you the truth, there has been a problem. You know what happened? There was one judge, and then he was replaced by another, and they were like looking into the different evidences or whatever that are there.
Which brings us to summarizing what's happening right now against Hezbollah, to be specific. Now, the atrocity summarized everything that is rotten about Lebanon's governing system, the corruption, the incompetent inaction, and the politicized judiciary system, which explains why it went to one judge and then to the other. Yet a large group of NGOs that were born directly after that explosion, who are funded by Western powers, are propagating that Hezbollah is behind the blast and that the regime is being held, and I quote, hostage by Hezbollah. Could you please tell us in what sectors are you guys holding the Lebanese regime hostage, if you don't mind me asking?
Well, this is... this is a joke, but no one likes such jokes, actually. When we talk about political things, when we talk about a country that is engulfed in such a huge problems, those people who are doing this, they are trying to mislead the public. They are trying to mislead the whole people in Lebanon and outside, because they are actually covering the face of the true criminal, and they are trying to... pinpoint to others who are not responsible. Actually, we have nothing whatsoever to do with what happened. We know this is a political agenda that has been trying to be put into effect through military actions, military operations, military aggressions. We remember this. I mean, this is for all of the public. We should understand that they are trying to get rid of the resistance one way or another. They started and continued this kind of military aggressions by Israel. It didn't work. Then they have the Takfiri groups, it didn't work. Then they came to this issue.
And
we
this is the second time a political accusation has been made against Hezbollah. And I want to talk more about this, Dr. Ibrahim, but we want to go to the second segment where we dive in into the accusations and what can be done to bring justice to people. Please stay with us.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Sure, knowing the truth will not bring our victims back. It will not heal out my youngest child, who still jumps in fear anytime there is a thunderstorm, although her face healed. And she now laughs about it, and she says it's a clown nose once she sees it in photographs. She stayed with the clown nose for weeks, and now she calls it the Big Bang. And when Lebanon's ruling elite pay for what they did, maybe we can have a change here in Lebanon and we can live it in a normal country. Lebanese authorities initially promised a swift investigation into the blast, vowing to deliver results within 5 days. Yes, 5 days. But over the past 12 months, the investigation into the biggest crime in Lebanon's history has been marked by little more than obstruction, evasion, and delay. Lebanon running out of political and economic chances in this following report.
On August 4th, 2020, a devastating blast in a warehouse destroyed much of the center of the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Many neighborhoods were destroyed. Downtown Beirut looked like a war zone. Thousands were injured and some 218 people tragically lost their lives on that day and the days that followed. For many, their poverty and livelihoods were literally blown away. The effects of those explosions are still reverberating 1 year later. The country is striving to find a path to emerge from a tragedy that has touched every single person. The destructive fallout of August 4th intensified suffering in Lebanon, which was already reeling from civil unrest, economic and financial hardship, increasing poverty and unemployment, compounded by political deadlock and a soaring number of COVID-19 cases. A year on from this tragedy, there is deepening hardships and mounting frustration. It is clear that the situation of ordinary people in Lebanon is worsening by the day. Currently, the UN estimates that more than 1 million Lebanese out of a population of almost 8 million, including more than 2 million refugees and migrants, need relief assistance to cover their basic needs, including access to food, health, education, and water. Lebanon, which not so long ago was a high middle-income country, is now facing probably the worst financial and economic crisis in its modern history. Over half of its population is living in poverty. It is perhaps not surprising that many people have lost trust in their leaders and institutions. It is regretful that Lebanon's leaders have been unable to reach agreement on the formation of a new government in the past 12 months, which has delayed urgently needed structural reforms to address the country's numerous challenges. This is a critical moment in Lebanon's history. The combined magnitude, depth, and multidimensionality of the political, socioeconomic, and humanitarian crisis facing Lebanon is unprecedented and presents an increasingly challenging landscape for people who still believe that change is possible. Much of the devastation from the blast is still visible. The port resembles a bomb site, and many buildings have been left in a state of collapse. Major questions remain unanswered, including why such a large shipment of ammonium nitrate, a highly explosive chemical used in bombs and fertilizer, was left stored in the middle of a crowded city for years after unloading in 2014. The immunity enjoyed by senior officials has raised suspicions among some families that there may never be accountability. But ultimately, the responsibility for avoiding the total collapse of Lebanon lies primarily in the hands of its leaders, who so far have shown no intention to truly relieve the suffering of the Lebanese population.
Now we continue with member of the Lebanese Parliament, Dr. Ibrahim Moussaoui from the Loyalty to the Resistance bloc Hezbollah. Thanks again, Dr. Ibrahim. Now, days ago, it was published in the media by Reuters, to be specific, that the FBI concluded after the blast that the amount of ammonium nitrate that blew up in Beirut port last year was 1/5 of the shipment unloaded there in 2014, adding to suspicions that much of the cargo has actually gone missing. Now, legally speaking, who is responsible for the whereabouts of such a shipment, and where on earth is the remaining part of the ammonium nitrate?
Well, this is a very excellent question, actually. First, I mean, this tragic event that happened, again, now we are 2 days from now, it will be the first anniversary. The answers are still being sought from the state, from the official side, from the judiciary. If you want exactly who's responsible, here we're talking about who's responsible for the port, for the Beirut port, for the cargo that are there. It's well known, officially, it's the Lebanese army. The Lebanese army is the one who's responsible for the cargo. It's not the general security, because I mean, it's only responsible for the individuals, not for the cargo or for the goods or whatever.
The other one,
it's the judiciary, because and I'm talking generally, this is in general, but if you go, when the judiciary, when this was reported to the judiciary, the judge, there's a judge who has taken a decision to confiscate this or to put it somewhere with all the reservations to be reserved, the official reservation on it. He is the one responsible, actually, and this has been said, actually, that when it is in the hands of the judiciary, because of the principle of the separation of powers, no one has the right to go and interfere in the work and the action and the function of the judiciary. So here we're talking about the judiciary system that is responsible and the judge who has taken a decision to put them aside and to have investigation over them.
Why wasn't he brought in to at least ask him a couple of questions?
This is one of the problems, actually. Why we have always called for the, if you want, for the sovereignty of the and the sovereignty and the independence of judiciary in Lebanon, and it has to do with the individuals themselves. To tell you, if you put the best system, if you write the best law, you need someone to put it into effect. Who do put it into effect? The people, the individuals. So when we talk about the individuals and the people, we are talking about judges. This judge who is responsible, he has not been summoned to be listened to or to hear him. There was no session of hearing. There was nothing. And actually, this is why the Lebanese parliament did not accept, actually, because you did not even do anything about this judge or other one responsible.
Well, this is what I want to ask you about. A probe into the port blast led by Judge Tariq Bitar has been hindered over the past month as requests sent to parliament and to government, the one that you're talking about, to lift immunity and enable questioning of several top officials. These demands were either declined or they were stalled. Why was it stalled or declined? And what is Hezbollah's stance on this, given that we see signatures of MPs, and we need just to understand why.
Well, to tell you, because I am a member of Justice and Administration Committee, I put my signature also on this list, actually, in order to make a list of accusation against the accused or those who thought of people, ministers or whatever. Why did we do that? Because when we got this appeal from Judge Bitar, we sent him a message. We held a meeting. This is the legal way. This is the legal way to do it, actually. Mm-hmm. We went, we brought all of the parliamentary committees in the parliament. We're talking about the Administration and Justice Committee, and we are talking, when you talk about Administration and Justice Committee, all of the Lebanese parties are represented in this. They are presented, and they are represented there. Mm-hmm. So you're talking about all the parliamentary blocks, they were there. When we started to discuss it, and when we heard those who are accused, there was nothing in the appeal. If you want someone to come to you as a judiciary, you should have brought, I'm not talking about evidences, you should bring some premises, something significant to convince us to not lift, as they say, the immunity. It's not a matter of lifting the immunity. What we have in the parliament is that when we have high treason by the ministers or by the president of the republic, we have the right to form a parliamentary committee, or we have the right to make this accusation. Actually, the Judge Bitar himself did not support, he did not supply us with anything in order to put this into effect. And we sent him a message.
So how come they asked to lift
him? We sent him a message again, and we told him, if you have anything, when we discussed this on the legal side, and all the parliamentary blocs, they were there, and they all accepted what we said, actually.
Then why was Hezbollah specifically targeted?
This is the important question. This tells you that this is the agenda. This is the agenda. This is what they wanted to do. We have been targeted because there is a hidden agenda to all of this. They want to accuse the party of different things because they want to mount the pressure from now till the coming elections, and they want to make this kind of wedge between the people and Hezbollah.
So it's purely a legal matter. But
it is a purely illegal. Mm-hmm. It's purely political.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm talking the lifting the immunity. It's a legal matter that needs evidence. That's why you did not allow.
Absolutely, I'll tell you what. You know what happened when the judge wanted? They put it into the media. You know, instead of sending it to the accused, to the ministers, to the parliamentarians, whoever they are, they heard it from the news. And you know, this is the public opinion, as we say. This is a kind of propaganda, public opinion. You are mobilizing the people against those persons without giving them the opportunity.
They are changing from illegal into a political propaganda.
Exactly.
But Lebanon is at a very decisive
And to tell you the truth, we have asked the judge, please resend us anything that could allow us, and we are ready to make a meeting at any time in order to lift the immunity, as you said. Mm-hmm. But he didn't provide us with anything tangible.
So it's now basically in the hands of Judge Bitar and what happens next. But Lebanon is at a decisive crossroad now, with Najib Miqati being the new prime minister designated instead of Saad al-Hariri. And people are criticizing his name, especially that Miqati has a responsibility to uphold, since he was prime minister when the ammonium nitrate entered the Beirut port, and he knows about that. What will Miqati be able to achieve here that Hariri was not? And what is your main concern as Hezbollah for the upcoming political and security reality in Lebanon? We have seen over the past couple of days a huge dive in security.
I'm not in a position to defend Prime Minister designate Miqati or to attack someone else. It's only that we have a way in order to come out of this problem. What is the way? The only way is to have to form a government. Now, who has nominated to this position? You know, when we talk about Lebanon, we talk about the priorities. We have a political system who come into a deadlock. We have a structural deficit. We have structural disorder in the political system itself. Now we are, as just like what you said, in a decisive, very sensitive, very crucial position in the economic level, in the political level, and on every level. Now, Saad al-Hariri, who was not successful to form the cabinet, he named in the name of the Sunni majority. Let's accept it. We live in a confessional system. Mm-hmm. He named Miqati to this position, and that's why we accepted this, and we have nominated him. We have named him. Why did we do that? Because this is the only way to try to make an attempt to come out of the stalemate of the problem of the crisis.
So hopefully we look forward into forming a government soon enough to try and lift the country from the political and economic challenges it is facing.
We don't say that we don't have problems. We don't say we don't have problems. We don't say that there are no flaws or mistakes. But this is the way that would lead us out, and hopefully we can do it.
Inshallah. Thank you very much, Dr. Ibrahim Moussaoui, Lebanese Member of Parliament, part of the Loyalty to the Resistance Bloc, Hezbollah. Thank you very much for being with us. And thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East stream.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
There are no pressure.
I come to you, and oh God, name that thou art our only king.
You're listening to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Dear listeners, welcome to another episode of Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. One of the main and most beautiful acts of worship, even we can say the most important act of worship that we have in Islam, is the salah, is the prayer, especially the five daily prayers. Now the salah itself and the prayer is not just the physical actions which we do, that is the standing up or the genuflection, that is going to ruku or the prostration or the sujood, but rather it is more than that. It has a deeper meaning. It is something that should enable us to transcend this terrestrial world and take our place amongst those who are close to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So this is what salah is. And obviously in order to do that, it is important for us to gain knowledge of the certain secrets that are within, or rather are contained within, the specific acts that are contained within the act of prayer, the act of salah. So inshallah, in this episode and hopefully in the next segment, we will be introducing one of those books that will enable us to get better acquainted with the prayer and with the act of praying. Inshallah, we hope to see you then. Please stay tuned.
All the earth is a place of prostration. Every field and meadow, mountain, park, city, farm, plantation. Every roadside, seaside, hillside, walkway, any place clean and green can be a place to pray. When I think of every path where I have ever trod, I laugh at all the crazy spots I stop to worship God. Remember that long car ride, driving all night so far. Under the summer moon, we pulled off to the side, reclining in the front seat of the car, waking to a fajr bird sound, and washing in the coin car wash we found with the water blaster making wound do. You sprayed me and I sprayed you. We stood so drowsy in the dawn behind the car wash dripping on the lawn. All the earth is a place of prostration. Every field and meadow, mountain, park, city, farm, plantation. Every roadside, seaside, hillside, walkway, any place clean and green can be a place to pray. When I think of every path where I have ever trod, I laugh at all the crazy spots and stop to worship.
Welcome back, dear brothers and sisters, to the show Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. In this episode, we are talking about the prayer, we're talking about Salah, and we mentioned that it is important for us to try and get a better acquaintance with the secrets, or rather the esoteric nature of the prayer. The book that we would like to introduce to our dear listeners today is a book that is titled The Radiance of the Secrets of Prayer. This book was originally written in Persian, or rather it was a set of lectures that was given on television in Persian, changed into a book in Persian, and then translated into English. The author is a well-known orator, Sheikh Mohsin Qaraati, who is more known or better known for his tafsir or commentary on the Holy Quran that is known as Tafsir al-Nur. This book was then translated by Brother Mansur Limba and was published by the Ahlul Bayt Wal Assembly that is located in the holy city of Qom in the Islamic Republic of Iran. So in this text, the Sheikh, that is Sheikh Mohsin Qaraati, attempts to explain in detail the meaning of worship and the acts and the parts of worship, or rather the acts of that act of worship. For example, intention. For example, the standing up. For example, the recitation, and so on and so forth. And therefore, he tries and attempts to explain the different actions of the prayer in detail and tries to then show and outline its importance and to make us better understand these actions. He says in the beginning and in the introduction that yes, you know, there are other books and other more valuable books out there dealing with this. For example, this is from myself, the book of Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayhi, that hopefully we may get a chance in one of our future episodes to introduce to our dear listeners, called Adabus Salah, and so on and so forth. But the point of this book is that it is for a general audience, and it relies greatly on the verses of the Holy Quran to make the readership better acquainted with Salah. This book contains 8 chapters, namely beginning with obviously the introduction and then going into worship or ibadah, prayer, Salah. Then the next chapter is titled Let's Welcome Prayer. So for example, the wudu and the other conditions of Salah. Then it goes into intention, the niyyah. Then it goes into a chapter that is titled Let's Engage in Prayer, which is a chapter that deals with the other acts of prayer, such as the qiyam or the standing, the takbir or, you know, the beginning of the prayer, and so on and so forth. Then the 2 last chapters deals with the post-prayer devotional acts. For example, what is known as the ta'aqibat. For example, the dua, the tasbih of Bibi Zahra, or the rosary of Bibi Zahra, or Lady Fatima Zahra, salamullah alayha. And then he goes into speak about the congregational prayer, the importance of it. And finally, he mentions other prayers such as Salatul Jum'ah, the prayer of Jum'ah, the prayer of Friday, Salatul Eid, the 2 Eid prayers, for example, and other recommended prayers that we are asked to perform or motivated to perform by the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wassalam. So inshallah, in our next segment, we will be reading a portion from this book for the benefit of our dear listeners. Please stay tuned.
There's no better feeling than when we pray on time, and we know the rest of our days will work out just fine. So we must work hard and wake up before sunrise, so we can leave our homes with the blessings of Allah. So we can leave our homes with the blessings of Allah. Feels good to leave our homes with the blessings of Allah.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. We were introducing to our dear listeners the book The Radiance of the Secrets of Prayer, written by Sheikh Mohsin Qaraati. And the section that we would like to read for our dear listeners is the section that the author titled Intention or Niyyah. This is an important part because it is the crux of Salah. It is the crux of the prayer. For everything depends obviously on the intention of the person performing that particular act. And therefore it was seen as necessary or beneficial for both myself and my dear listeners to read a section or read this section from the book. So the author writes, Intention, Niyyah. Since intention, Niyyah, is the criterion of value in every act, including worship, it is the first obligatory act in prayer. Considering its importance, a separate and lengthy chapter has been included for the examination of its dimensions, with the hope that by doing so, we would succeed in giving more value to all devotional acts. Intention niyyah as a criterion of value. The element that gives importance to a person's actions is his intention, motive or objective. So in the verses of the Quran, the phrase in the way of Allah, fi sabilillah, is often used 70 times, and thus a warning for people to ensure that their actions and intentions be in the way of God, and not for the sake of other than God, or their own carnal desires. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to enable us to have pure intentions and to purify our intentions when we come and stand in front of Him at His threshold. Inshallah, until our next episode, my dear brothers and sisters. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
We get people.
Record in overdose.
The US has seen a sharp spike in the number of overdose deaths across the country since the coronavirus pandemic began. According to official estimates, deaths caused by drug overdose hit a new record of 93,000 people last year.
You don't ever heal from losing a child. I think we just learn to live differently. I think that we should all be aware of the crisis we're in, and I absolutely do not want this to happen to another family.
Hello and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Mila Javamardi. The official figure translates to nearly 255 deaths every single day caused by drug abuse. In this episode, we'll delve into the repercussions of addiction to find out how overdose cases affect the victims, their families, and the society in general. And we will also ask, who is to blame for the spike in overdoses? And has the government done enough to address the issue?
Our children are dying and no one's helping us. It's frustrating. We're weary. We're tired.
How would you describe the pain of losing someone like your son and the way he died?
Seeing him in the way that we saw him that morning will forever be embedded in my head, and I'll never be the same. And so I will be his voice for the rest of my life.
Opioids, sometimes called narcotics, are a type of drug. They include strong prescription pain relievers, such as oxycodone, hydrocodone, fentanyl, and tramadol. The illegal drug heroin is also an opioid. Some opioids are made from the opium plant, and others are synthetic or man-made. The number of drug overdose deaths increased by nearly 5% from 2018 to 2019, and has quadrupled since 1991. Over 70% of the 70,630 deaths in 2019 involved an opioid. From 2018 to 2019, opioid-involved death rates increased by over 6%. Opioids can cause side effects such as drowsiness, mental fog, nausea, and constipation. They may also cause slowed breathing, which can lead to overdose deaths. A state-by-state analysis showed that the rise in overdose deaths affected every single state, except New Hampshire and South Dakota. Significantly larger increases have been reported from certain states such as Kentucky, Vermont, South Carolina, West Virginia, and California.
Addiction is literally wiping out my entire generation and the next generation at this point.
The behavioral health intervention team works to make contact with people who have experienced an overdose within the first 24 to 48 hours of occurrence, and we attribute that to the life-saving Narcan that's being pushed out into the community.
Just keep going, okay? Do not stop compressions, you got it?
The national figure is showing a 30% spike compared to 2019, necessitating close attention from authorities. Dying of overdose is just one part of the problem. There is also overdose from which people survive, and then there is the issue of addiction. In many cases, addictions end up ruining marriages, friendships, and careers. We're now joined by white-collar criminologist William Black. Dr. Black is also a lawyer, author, and professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you.
William, first of all, how much could such overdoses impact the victims' communities and families?
So this is one of the important avoidable causes of death. And you're just talking about deaths. Obviously, there are many more overdoses, and those are exceptionally scary. People are rushed to the emergency room. They and their friends don't know whether they're going to survive. And people are also addicted. And when they're addicted, they're much less productive, they're much less happy, and they can't work, and they tend to commit crimes to get money for their drugs. So basically all of the things about opioids are terrible. That's what we feel.
Many thanks for your insight. We'll hear more of your analysis later on in the program.
Generally speaking, the single most serious health problem in the United States is abuse of alcohol, tobacco, as well as drugs. The main cause of hospital and rehab admissions is excessive consumption of alcohol, usually by adults, while the younger generation faces novel chemical drugs in the black market. Opioid misuse, addiction, and overdoses are serious public health problems in the United States today. Another problem is that more women are misusing opioids during pregnancy. This can lead to babies being addicted and going through withdrawal, known as neonatal abstinence syndrome. Opioid misuse may sometimes also lead to heroin use, because some people switch from prescription opioids to heroin.
As a tobacco user, their body and brain get used to functioning on a certain level of nicotine. If they quit, that means their body need to learn how to function without nicotine. This adjustment process will make them feel uncomfortable and cause withdrawal symptoms.
Out of the over 20 million Americans with at least one addiction in the United States, only 10% are treated and the rest stay on the perilous path, which could potentially end with an overdose. Our next guest is Deborah Fairholden, Director of Public Health Division at Michigan State University. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Deborah, is there a relation between the coronavirus pandemic and the spike in the number of overdoses across the country?
We were making tremendous progress in the opioid crisis prior to the coronavirus pandemic. In fact, after the Department of Health and Human Services declared the opioid epidemic in the U.S., we saw in the year that followed between 2018 and 2019 our first significant decrease in opioid overdose deaths in more than 20 years. What happened during the coronavirus pandemic is we saw major disruptions in behavioral health services. People who were in substance abuse treatment and opioid treatment, for example, were sent home with bottles of medication. They had disruption in all of the normal care and services that they get. Many of the life-saving measures that we had in place, like the distribution of Narcan, which is an overdose prevention medication, many of those things were stopped in their tracks.
Very well. Many thanks for your insight as well, Deborah. We'll hear more of your analysis, too, later on in the program.
We know that there have been three waves of opioid overdose deaths in the United States. This rise in opioid overdose deaths can be outlined in three distinct waves. The first wave began with the increased prescription of opioids in the 1990s, with overdose deaths involving prescription opioids. The second wave began in 2010, with rapid increases in overdose deaths involving heroin. The third wave began in 2013, with significant increases in overdose deaths involving synthetic opioids, particularly those involving illicitly manufactured fentanyl. The market for illicitly manufactured fentanyl continues to change, and it can be found in combination with heroin, counterfeit pills, and cocaine. The opioid crisis began by overprescription of drugs such as OxyContin in those who sought treatment for health problems like chronic headaches. The move had been promoted by Big Pharma and companies like Purdue Pharmaceuticals.
Today's announcement involves one of the most important participants in the supply chain of prescription opioids at the manufacturer level, and a resolution which, if approved by the court, will redress past wrongs and will also provide extraordinary new resources for the treatment and care of those affected by opioids addiction. The global settlement announced today involves the company pleading guilty to three felony counts for defrauding the United States and violating the anti-kickback statute from 2009 to 2017.
Take a single middle-aged mom. Her chances of becoming an addict by purchasing drugs in a local park are not really high. But after going to the doctor, she's prescribed opioids immediately, which could ultimately turn her into an addict. The practice set a perilous precedence for America, from which it is still suffering.
The opioids were created as an epidemic by the combination of what we call big pharma, big pharmaceutical companies, and pain doctors, and on the basis of two lies. One was that opioids were a good thing to give people for chronic pain that would last potentially for months or years, and second, that they were incredibly non-addictive.
The crisis claimed the lives of nearly 50,000 people in opioid-involved overdoses in 2019. To this day, families in America have had to pay the price for what Big Pharma did for the sake of making more profit. Various tactics have been used to coax not just the patients, but also the staff at companies like Purdue, the OxyContin maker, to boost the market of prescription opioids.
How would you characterize your 5 years as a sales representative at Purdue Pharma?
When I started in 2008, that